Now, it goes without saying that the world is filled with all sorts of different people. People who vary in culture, religion, attitudes, beliefs, ways of life. But if there's something that binds people across history and around the globe, it's a loathing of homosexuality. Michael King is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at University College London, and he's spent two decades trying to work out why homophobia is so present across time and place. Michael speaking with Amanda Smith.
Now, Michael, we've just had the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras in Sydney. Marriage equality exists in a number of countries now. So just how widespread is homophobia nowadays?
It seems to be very widespread, and it can be in any sort of form. It's not necessarily bullying or hitting someone on the street. It's often the attitudes of people, and there are subtle forms of homophobia that happen all the time. And we think this is the origin of mental distress in lesbian and gay people because it's more common. Lesbian and gay people seem to suffer from depression and anxiety more than so-called straight or heterosexual people.
We'll get onto that in a minute because I know that's a key area of your research. But I just want to know, historically, across cultures, why the loathing for homosexuality? I mean, it's a sort of fundamental question that we don't necessarily think to ask, in a way.
It's very complex and very interesting. And nearly all societies across millennia have not liked same-sex behaviour. It's not so much homosexuality, because homosexuality is a very modern term. It was the end of the 19th century where it first appeared. It was more men having sex together or women having sex together. That was what was loathed. And it seems to originate from religion. Nearly all religions are opposed to same-sex behaviour. But it also, it seems to follow patriarchal societies. In other words, societies where men are in charge, and let's face it, that's most of them. It seems to be something that men dislike. And we see this. Homophobia seems to be more common in men generally than women, not entirely. And particularly against gay male, same sex. And it could be the sense that men are giving up their masculine status in some way. They're sort of becoming women, in quotes. And women are not as equal as men. So it's historically very complex. It may also be related to the fact that people feared it, that men who had sex with other men or women that had sex with other women were giving up the idea of family, of children, procreation. So there's many, many origins to this.
It does occur to me, though, ancient Greece, you know, I mean, the culture of homosexuality that existed there.
Yes, that's
interesting. Is that an exception?
It appears to be, and it also appears to be a rather exaggerated exception. It really was aristocratic men who had relationships with younger men. It was seen as a sort of training or tuition.
Yes, almost. It was a sort of mentorship.
Yes, exactly.
In a way.
But the idea that in any modern sense that they form a long-term enduring relationship really was unacceptable. These men would be married. They would continue their normal family life. So it wasn't...
It was, in fact, a stage they were going through.
Almost, in a sense. And that's the funny sort of view that persisted even into modern times.
Well, one might argue, though, that if condemnation of homosexuality has been so widespread historically and culturally, then there must be something in it. You know, it must be right. What would you say to that?
Well, that's an interesting perception. But condemnation doesn't equal right. You know, the black races have often been condemned by the white races, or women having any sort of role in religion is often condemned. But these things are just culturally based. And, you know, you have to be very, very careful to say that something's right because it's condemned. It's often very wrong and very cruel to the people on the receiving end.
Just picking up on a couple of things you've said already, where there's homophobia, there's also sexism, yeah? I mean, do the two go hand in hand?
They seem to travel together. If you look at societies that are very sexist, where men are in charge, you'll often find a lot of homophobia. And it's curious that those go together. But just as I was saying before, it's coming from this idea of masculinity and masculine power. And therefore, countries, you know, across Africa, across the Arab world, where, you know, there really is a really dominant role for men, we find homophobia. Masculinity, it's related to gender much more than we perhaps realize. femininity in boys or masculinity in girls is not liked. Somehow it's feared. And that's the source of bullying in schools. Kids in schools are not bullied because they're gay. They often don't know they are. It's because they're not quite masculine enough.
Is there any religion that hasn't condemned homosexuality?
Shintoism in Japan seems to be the only real exception. And people don't know why. It may be because it doesn't have a written text in the way that other religions do. So things weren't laid down in a kind of legal way. But even the, say, take the Christian religion, Christ never mentioned homosexuality. It comes from St. Paul. And even then, it was seen as heterosexual people turning away to what he regarded as perverse same-sex behavior. It wasn't homosexuality in the way we regard it today, as people who want enduring faithful relationships with someone of their own sex. That just didn't come into the cultural understanding. So it's not really clear what these religions were getting at.
Well, now, as I mentioned, you specialise in the mental health of LGBT populations. Can you talk about how homophobia affects individuals, particularly how it compares, I think, to other forms of discrimination, racism, for example, as you mentioned?
Yes, it's interesting. We've felt that, you know, in modern societies where there's less homophobia, there should be less mental distress in gay people, but it doesn't appear that that's the case. Many young gay men and lesbians still have higher rates of mental disorder than heterosexuals. So you might ask, well, why is this? And it's this idea of growing up as different right from late childhood and adolescence. Many gay and lesbian people hide the fact that they are at first, even in today's society, but they have no one to talk to. So they live this isolated life where they're always covering up, pretending, trying to be something they're not. And we see that as a kind of microaggression. It's a funny word, but there are little slants all the time against a lifestyle that they may want. They can't talk to their parents. Their parents might be opposed.
And one that's I think, possibly a key thing if you look at that discrimination compared to other forms, which is that you are isolated from your family. Say if you experience racism, you're still likely to have the support of your family, aren't you?
Absolutely. So homophobia enters the family, and that it makes it very different to almost any other ism, if you like. And therefore, it's devastating. And people feel completely alone. Now, the trouble is, as they grow up, they don't lose that feeling. They don't lose the feeling of always pretending, always working out how they should be with this particular person or that particular person. So it's a life of standing on thin ice, and therefore it can lead to all sorts of strain and stress over the long term, not just a short-term trauma. It can be a long-term, spun-out, difficult way to live.
This is Life Matters. I'm Amanda Smith with Michael King, who's Professor of Psychiatry at University College London and visiting Australia at the moment. His special subject is the nature of homophobia. Now, Michael, you're a psychiatrist, and if there's one group of people who've got a fraught history with homosexuality, it's surely psychiatrists. Have you all stopped trying to cure it?
Very interesting point. It's not just psychiatrists, of course. It's psychoanalysts and psychologists, anyone working in the mental health field. Because for years across the 20th century, we as a profession tried to make homosexual people heterosexual. And through all sorts of odd treatments for which there was no evidence, and reparative therapies in the United States, so-called reparative therapies, are a kind of spiritual way to try and change people. None of them work. And the trouble is they also cause much more damage. Now, the trouble is psychiatry and psychology have flipped completely the other way now, so that some gay people who are desperate to change are fearful to come to them because they think the psychiatrist will be too liberal. So,
Have you had that experience?
Yes, I've had that experience, so you really can't win. But it is very important to emphasise that these conversion treatments just simply don't work.
Tell me about what the conversion therapies involve, you know, and how commonly practised.
Well, sometimes it's difficult to know what they involve. Originally, psychoanalysts tried through psychotherapy to help people become heterosexual. The assumption was that it was some kind of faulty learning, that we're all we all have this concrete substrate of heterosexuality, and you just need to get the person to return to it. Trouble is, that's simply not true. And so you're trying to make a person who's fundamentally attracted to same-sex experiences to become something different. And we know that it's probably biological and constitutional. So to do that is really very disruptive to the person. In the mid-20th century, the behaviourists came along. They were the people who felt that they could change faulty learning, but they were even more destructive. I don't think, however, they were sadists. They were just trying to make people happier. And they could see that if you could be heterosexual in the mid-20th century, you might be happier than if you're homosexual. So many of them were working from the best possible motives, but that's the trouble. When people work from the best possible motives, they don't always know the damage they're doing.
Are those sort of conversion therapies still practiced at all anywhere in the world?
It's hard to tell. Much less now, but the reparative therapies that I mentioned a minute ago were very common in the States up until about 5 or 10 years ago. They're starting to fall apart now because they're seeing the damage that's done. And the scientific community are confronting them and say, well, just no evidence that this is helpful.
So do you see a role for psychiatry, psychotherapy, psychology, etc. now, not to try to cure homosexuality, but to try to cure homophobia?
Ah, well, a good point. I don't think it's necessarily in the field of psychiatry or psychology, really. This is a cultural and social phenomenon, and it's the world that needs to change in a way. And so it takes all of us, really, to see that homophobia is just another nasty thing in our community, like racism or ageism. So I don't think psychology or psychiatry have that role. I think they can be there to help the casualties of that and to help people see that they can be ordinary people in our community. But we won't really know what the situation's like until we have completely equal societies. So it's a social thing, in my view.
So then, in countries where you've got data, Michael, how does the mental health of gay people compare to the mental health of heterosexual people? Do you actually have data on that?
Yes, there's good data from across most of the Western world. So I'm talking about Europe, North America, Australasia. And they're not doing well. They have between 2 and 5 times the rates of depression, suicide attempts, abuse of alcohol. So it's quite sad, and we're worried because you would have thought in the more equal societies, young people now would be better off. You know, these rates of mental disorder would be lessening, but they're not very much. That's the worrying question.
Well, again, I mean, that might suggest there's a fundamental problem with gayness itself.
And that's exactly what people who come from very conservative or religious stances would say. They'd say, well, you know, people have made a disordered choice, so they end up with disordered mental lives. I don't think that's the case at all. It's not a choice to be homosexual or heterosexual. It's something you grow up to be. But it just shows that although society seems on the surface to be okay about it, it isn't. Why is it still the commonest cause of bullying in schools? That shows that even among the youth, it's still not acceptable to stand outside what's seen as the heterosexual norm. And as I said earlier, it's to do with gender. People just can't seem to bear people who are not fully masculine or fully feminine as they see it.
Professor Michael King. He's a psychiatric epidemiologist at the University College London. He's visiting Australia at the moment, and he was in conversation with Amanda Smith earlier this week. My name's Michael McKenzie. I'm with you for the best of life matters.